from the North Carolina Reading Service. It's the Indie Week, and it's dated September the 7th, 2022. I'm John Feddersen, reading for our blind and print-impaired audience. I'm accompanied today by the full forces of the Tierra del Fuego Philharmonic. Both of them happen to be visiting on vacation in the area this afternoon, and we're sure grateful for their participation. And let's get on with our Indie Week. And as a reminder, the Indie Week on paper, which is dated the 7th of September, was printed yesterday for me, and up to date is the indieweek.com, which has one day later datelined articles, and a few of them are of interest right now, and I'll start with reading some of them first. So this is by Kirk Ross from NC Policy Watch. Latest polling, favorability ratings, is influencing the North Carolina Senate race. It's probably just a coincidence that the Pantone company chose Very Perry, a vibrant purple, as its 2022 color of the year, but it would be hard to find a better shade to describe North Carolina's electorate. Both are trending this fall. Last week, yet another poll showed the U.S. Senate race between Representative Ted Budd and former state Supreme Court's Chief Justice Sherry Beasley effectively tied, the third poll in a row to do so. Early on, head-to-head polls showed Budd well in the lead, but the last time he was up beyond the margin of error was mid-June. Tom Jensen, director of the Raleigh-based Public Policy Polling, whose most recent poll has Beasley up by 1%, said what's happening here is similar to other key races around the country. The trend in Beasley's numbers reflects a significant uptick in enthusiasm nationwide among Democratic voters following the U.S. Supreme Court's Dobbs decision in late June overturning constitutional protections for abortion. It's a dynamic that's led to a decoupling of the president's approval rating and prospects for Democratic candidates here and elsewhere. North Carolina's contest is drawing more attention nationally, and several ratings organizations have either shifted their calls on the race to toss-up or are considering it. Jensen said, if we were talking a year and a half ago and you told me that on September 6, 2022, nationally, Biden's going to have 40% approval, 53% disapproval, I'd say Democrats are headed for getting wiped out across the board. That's not the case because of the energy the Supreme Court gave to the Democratic base because of the concern about abortion. Jensen said that energy and a field of good candidates have changed the odds in a cycle that typically skews against the president's party. He said, in 2018, you knew it was going to be a great year for Democrats. In 2010 and 2014, you knew it was going to be a great year for Republicans. This year, it's a lot more complicated than that. In North Carolina's race, the PPP's top-line numbers are close and mirror the state's fairly even partisan split. The poll of 601 voters, August 29-30, has Beasley with a slight lead over Budd, 42-41%, with 12% undecided. Libertarian Shannon Bray was at 5%, and Green Party candidate Matthew Ho at 1%. But beyond that, the responses show some wide gaps between Beasley and Budd, most notably in favorability. Beasley was above water in the PPP poll at 40% favorable, 30% unfavorable, 30% not sure, while Budd, 34% favorable, 40% unfavorable, and 26% not sure. For Biden, 54% of those surveyed disapproved of how he's doing his job, 41% approved, and 6% were not sure. This week, a High Point University poll showed a similar dynamic in a survey that didn't directly poll the Senate race, but focused on voters' preferences. The survey of 786 registered voters from August 18 through 25 put Beasley at 37% favorable, 30% unfavorable, 33% unsure. Bud at 28% favorable, 41% unfavorable, and 31% unsure. Jensen said there's also an important story within those overall favorable-unfavorable numbers. Beasley's favorability with Democrats is at 75%, and at 80% of those who voted for Biden in the last election. Bud's favorability with Republicans is at 51%, and 54% of those who voted for former President Trump, who has backed Bud since mid-2021. Democrats are super excited about Beasley, and Republicans are not that excited about Ted Budd, said Jensen. It's a distinction that could make a difference in turnout. At its core, he said, we're a 50-50 state. And in 2020, Republicans won most everything, 51-49, because they turned out at a rate 6 points higher than Democrats. The big question over the next 9 weeks is whether that enthusiasm gap offsets the turnout advantage Republicans had in 2020. That poll, PPP, shows the favorability gap even wider among voters from 18 to 45 age, now the state's largest group by registration, but a demographic with traditionally lower turnout. Catawba College political science professor Michael Bitzer, who's been chronicling the generational shifts in voting patterns, said voter turnout among Gen Z and millennial voters has been steadily growing. Their turnout rate was about 20 percentage points lower than the statewide rate in 2018, but in 2020, that had dropped to 14 percentage points lower. If turnout among younger voters continues to increase, then the state's purple status starts shifting bluer in the long term, said Bitzer. This year, that could mean a different voter pool than was expected going into this cycle. If voters under 40 are truly energized, then things could track very differently from what we might expect. But it would continue a trend that has been evident for at least two election cycles now in this state. Both Jensen and Bitzer said, given the stakes, they're confident that 2022 should maintain the state's trend toward higher turnout elections. Both point to the last 2 years as an indication that turnout this year will again be heavy. There was a 75% voter turnout in that hotly contested 2020 presidential cycle, the highest since 1968. 2 years before that, 2018 defied off-year trends. And Bitzer said, for 2018's blue moon election cycle, with no U.S. Senate race or other race or other major statewide race, it was 53%. For comparison, 2010 and 14 were 43% and 44%, respectively. That was impressive. The next article, again datelined today, September the 8th, in other words, Tomasi MacDonald, emancipate NC officials, call on the Durham Council to pay Daryl Howard $6 million. A federal grand jury awarded him that money after he spent decades in prison for a wrongful conviction of murder. Durham officials cite an arcane law that's stopping them from paying him. Officials with the statewide agency that advocates for criminal justice reform this week called on Durham City Council members to pay Howard the $6 million a federal grand jury call awarded to him. This injustice, said North Carolina Emancipate officials in a Monday afternoon press release, this injustice flies in the face of commitments Durham City Council has made to police accountability and civil rights. It reflects bad public policy and is morally wrong. And Howard and the director of Emancipate, Kerwin Pittman, along with Emancipate NC attorney Don Blagrove, were on the agenda for public comment during Monday's regularly scheduled city council meeting with the intention of, quote, demanding that council members fulfill their obligation to pay that judgment to Mr. Howard, according to a press release made public Monday afternoon. However, a city official during the Monday night meeting informed Mayor Elaine O'Neill that she had spoken with Blagrove and referred her to the public comment section of Thursday's City Council work session. Blagrove said, Durham should be ashamed of itself. A city so often touted for progressivism led by black people should understand the deep debt it owes to a black man robbed of his freedom by a corrupt and racist system. pay for the harm of your racist law enforcement and make your deeds match your words. But city officials say their hands are tied. They're prohibited from granting Howard the jury award owing to an arcane, decades-old city ordinance. As the Indy previously reported, a jury concluded late last year, at the end of a nearly month-long civil rights trial, that a police detective had manufactured evidence that resulted in Howard spending more than two decades behind bars after he was wrongly convicted for the murders of 29-year-old Doris Washington and her 13-year-old Nishonda Washington in 1991. On December 1st, 2016, after Howard had served more than 23 years behind bars, Durham Senior Resident Superior Court Judge Orlando Hudson ordered that his convictions be vacated and that he be released from prison following a DNA analysis that indicated he was innocent. On April 30th, 2021, Governor Roy Cooper issued Howard a pardon of innocence. He received $750,000 in compensation. Howard says about the time he spent locked up, "There was a lot of abuse. I worked in segregation, where you see the worst in prison. I used to think, why, God, why did you choose something like me for this?" On December 1st, 2021, a jury in the U.S. District Court's Middle District Durham Division deliberated about an hour before determining that former Durham Police Detective Darryl Dowdy had violated Howard's civil rights when he fabricated evidence and demonstrated, quote, a bad faith failure to investigate the double murders. City Attorney Kimberly Rayberg told Indy the City Council's decision was made following a series of closed-door sessions soon after that federal jury's verdict to award between December 2021 and February of this year. Rayberg stated via a series of emails to Indy that the City Council's decision not to pay hinged on a single paragraph approved by the City Council four decades ago. The city's two-and-a-half-page resolution establishing uniform standards under which claims or civil judgments sought or entered against city officers and employees may be paid was approved by City Council members on September the 8th, 1981. Section 5 of Resolution 3115 states, quote, whereas it is in the public interest that claims made or judgments entered against officers or employees of the city be satisfied by the city, if the facts and circumstances of the claim or suit in which the judgment is entered show that the officer or employee was engaged in the good faith performance of his duty on behalf of the city when the act or omission giving rise to the claim or suit occurred. A jury of Dowdy's peers, quote, determined that Mr. Dowdy engaged in fabrication of evidence and a bad faith failure to investigate, Rayberg explained. But Emancipate NC officials in their release said the City Council's reason for not paying Howard is, quote, based on spurious legal grounds, and that the city's elected leaders must meet their responsibility for just compensation. Ian Mance, Emancipate North Carolina's senior counsel, said the state's general statutes do not bar Durham from paying that judgment. He said the council's hands are not tied. They have all the authority they need to pay Mr. Howard what he is owed. Pittman, the agency director, asked members of the public and city council members to pause and place themselves in Howard's shoes. He said in a press statement, "You've been kidnapped from your loved ones and unjustly incarcerated in a cage, made to endure over 20 years of hard time for a crime you knew you didn't commit. Finally released, only to be tormented yet again by unnecessary and unwarranted state-sanctioned violence." The City Council work session today, Thursday, that's today, begins at 1 p.m., so it's already underway as I speak. Finally, from the online edition, to address child abuse, Congressman Ted Budd should vote to put money where his mouth is, writes Jane Porter. Wannabe U.S. Senator Ted Budd has a lot of thoughts about child abuse in public schools, so many, in fact, he directed a letter to Governor Roy Cooper demanding the governor detail procedures in in place to protect children in North Carolina schools. Bud cites two serious child abuse cases. A recent case in Fairfax, Virginia, where a school counselor retained his job after he was convicted of soliciting a minor, and the startling allegations contained in a 2021 lawsuit that outlined decades of abuse of students by staff at the North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. Here's the rub, though. As a three-term sitting member of Congress, instead of paying lip service, Bud has had ample opportunity to vote for bills that would actually allocate money, some $890 million, to programs designed to prevent child abuse and help victims of child abuse heal. And guess what? Bud passed. In 2021, Bud voted against the bipartisan House Resolution 485, the Stronger Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act, that authorizes $540 million to expanding services related to child abuse prevention and research programs through 2027. The resolution cleared the House in a 345-73 vote. Bud and 72 other Republicans voted nay, and allocates $270 million to expanding child abuse prevention services to more than 3 million children each year. It also allocates $270 million for new research and support for state child protective service agencies to expand their services. Additionally, the resolution would establish a national electronic registry of child abuse cases, seek to address racial bias across the child welfare system, specifically for children whose parents struggle with addiction, and expand physical and mental health care services. The resolution is currently stalled in a U.S. Senate committee. But that's not all. In 2021, there was the American Rescue Plan Act, also known as the Stimulus Bill. The House Freedom Caucus member voted against that one, too. During the pandemic, when rates of child abuse were known to have been increasing, as children couldn't attend school and families were avoiding emergency room visit, the American Rescue Plan provided $350 million for child abuse prevention programs, including Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act and community-based child abuse prevention programs. Bud derided the American Rescue Plan as a liberal wish list, but it allocated $100 million in supplemental funding for CAPTCHA grants, which provide funds to states to improve their child protective service system. North Carolina received more than $3 million in CAPTCHA grants from that bill, and the money was used to fund programs to prevent child abuse and for community services. Bud would be better off to ask not what Governor Cooper is doing to protect children in North Carolina, but take a look at his own voting record and start making better spending choices for North Carolina's children, about whom he claims to care so much. The congressman in his letter is demanding a response from the governor's office by tomorrow. Lena Geller now to the print edition of The Independent Indie Week with Might and Main, from reporting from Durham. 116 years after its founding, Walltown, one of Durham's oldest historically black neighborhoods, finally has an official gateway. A wide brick lectern, the result of more than two decades of community lobbying, was unveiled at a joyful celebration of intergenerational advocacy on West Club Boulevard last Saturday. Before the big reveal, Walltown residents paid homage to the neighborhood's founder, George Wall, who worked at Duke University's first custodian after gaining his freedom from slavery in the early 20th century. By building a house on a vacant block next to Duke's East Campus, residents remembered, Wall laid the foundations for the area that would become home to generations of black working-class families in Durham. The sign was unveiled in front of the Walltown Recreation Center, a building that Walltown Community Association, WCA, member Brandon Williams describes as another marker of community organizing. in the 1950s. Walltown residents elected a man named Frizzell Day as the bronze mayor of the neighborhood, Williams says. Day, spelled D-A-Y-E, who worked as a janitor at City Hall, used his proximity to folks in power to secure land for a community center in Walltown. Because the city didn't give Day any funding, residents pooled their resources and constructed a one-room building themselves. The neighborhood's current recreation center, which broke ground in 2009, stands on the same piece of land as its predecessor. Williams says, you have this history of working-class black folks who just figured out how to navigate a society around them, despite the discrimination and structural inequities present. This history, he said, is what fuels the community in its current fight. Walltown has experienced rampant gentrification since the turn of the century, as Durham ascended to the top of best places to live lists, and wealthy white transplants sought homes in the vicinity of Duke and downtown. Lifelong Walltown residents, thwarted from building wealth by decades of redlining, started to be displaced by rising property taxes. Developers, spotting opportunity in residents who were struggling to make ends meet, swayed many to sell their homes and then flipped the properties for a tenfold payoff. So in 2018, when a global real estate firm acquired Northgate Mall, a neighbor to Walltown since the 1960s, and announced plans for a dramatic transformation of the 55-acre property, the WCA, determined to protect its community from further gentrification, sprung into action. The firm, Northwood Raven, had announced plans for a pedestrian-friendly, mixed-use development with public plazas and retail, office, and residential space. WCA members decided they would draw up a plan, too. They spent a year canvassing and holding focus groups within Walltown, asking residents what they hoped to see at the Northgate site, and then organized with seven other neighborhoods to form a Northgate Mall Neighborhood Council, NMNC, and to survey folks in surrounding neighborhoods. In September 2020, after gathering feedback from more than 600 residents, the NMNC created three alternative site maps for the new Northgate. Each map included components of their equitable community-centered vision: a significant portion of affordable housing with first right of purchase and rental provided to low-income Walltown residents, affordable retail, including a grocery store, accessible green space that bridges Walltown Park with the other side of Guess Road, a transportation hub for buses and bike riders, and sustainable infrastructure to reduce flooding. For a while, the WCA members felt like they were making progress. While Northwood Raven wasn't particularly engaging, the City Council seemed receptive to their vision and willing to advocate to the developer on their behalf. They'd also succeeded in adding Walltown to the city's longtime homeowners grant program, which assists owners with rising property taxes. Then, in a virtual meeting 2 weeks ago, Northwood Raven announced it was abandoning its original site plan. The new plan, as spokespeople revealed, is largely dominated by a life sciences research campus with a few restaurants and the central one-acre green space. To the WCA members' dismay, the map no longer includes any residential space. Williams says, for our vision of what needs to happen there at the site, not having housing is really a non-starter. The other benefits don't make a whole lot of sense if we're not building them around people. Northwood Raven did not reply to requests for comment for this story, but one of the firm's attorneys, Patrick Biker, attended the Walltown Gateway unveiling on Saturday. Biker told the Indy and a handful of concerned residents that including residential space in the project would be, quote, financially unfeasible, but that the firm is planning to help the Walltown community through, quote, job creation. Biker told that handful of concerned residents the firm is planning to help through job creation. The proposed life science campus would provide lots of job opportunities for residents who don't have college degrees, he said. At places like Pfizer, people who only have high school diplomas are, quote, pulling down really good money. The pitch was clear. The developer's representative was trying to convince residents that Northwood Raven is on their side. Residents seemed appreciative of Biker's presence, but were understandably skeptical of his motive. It took decades for Walltown to get an official gateway. How long will it take for developers to storm through it? Though Northwood Raven's new site plan is a stark repudiation of the WCA Community Center proposal, it may come with a silver lining. To enact its new vision, the firm must file a rezoning request to change the property's commercial center classification, which currently prohibits the construction of a life science research campus, to commercial general. According to City Council member Jillian Johnson, the rezoning case, which will go to the council for approval, will allow councillors to fight for the WCA proposal in a way they previously could not. Johnson says, "The Walltown Community Association doing all this planning was a little bit activistic at the time because there weren't really any actual levers for influence. But a rezoning case is completely discretionary on the part of the City Council. So now there is a really strong opportunity for this community vision to have influence on this site." Johnson, while clarifying that she won't make a decision about the rezoning until the public hearing, and noting that it's illegal to deny a rezoning request based on the existence or lack thereof of affordable housing, says she feels, quote, very comfortable with holding her vote until developers do better. "This is an ideal spot for some dense residential development," Johnson says. Over the past few years, Northwood Raven has been dismissive of the council's requests to incorporate the WCA vision into its plan, Johnson says, and because the firm's previous site map was within the property's zoning code, there wasn't much the council could do to change its mind. While advocates have pushed for the council to initiate its own rezoning and thus ensure the development would incorporate components of the community vision, Johnson says this wasn't feasible. Quote, "You can have a city-initiated rezoning, but once a property is in the process of being development, that becomes legally complex and is not generally a good idea for us to try to use rezoning authorities. There would be a lawsuit, and we would lose." Nate Baker, an urban planner who serves on Durham's Planning Commission, says Johnson's fear of losing a lawsuit is questionable, adding, quote, "It's disappointing that our leadership is so afraid of doing anything progressive." "There are plenty of ways the city could have taken action in recent years," he says. Baker spoke with the Indy on his own behalf, and his views don't necessarily reflect those of the city's planning commission. He said, "They could have done a small area planning process on that site and then used the power of zoning to implement that. We can regulate uses, what is or is not allowed on the site, the arrangement of what's on the site, the infrastructure, creating new city blocks that weave into the existing fabric of surrounding neighborhoods on that site, for example." The council had plenty of time. The neighborhood was asking for help long before this subdivision was submitted. Baker says though council members have missed opportunities to take action, they still have time. Quote, "Durham is at a crossroads about how we engage and empower residents around the issues of growth and development. The Northgate Mall redevelopment is an indicator and maybe even a harbinger event that shapes what Durham is and who we become." Going on Biker's presentation at the unveiling, Northwood Raven's vision for the Northgate property is one that would be familiar to George Wall and Frizzell Day, where Walltown residents work blue-collar jobs at the conglomerate across the street. Instead of investing in the WCA's proposal, the firm is offering, at best, proximity to leadership. Brett Chambers, an NC Central University professor who spent childhood summers at his grandmother's house in Walltown, says that Biker's pitch is reminiscent of empty promises he's heard from other developers in Durham, saying, "They always say you're going to be benefited. We'll have job creation. And all they're doing is lining their pockets. I don't want the people that are left in Walltown to have only cashier and clerk and janitor jobs. I don't want the next young man to have to grow up and only have that choice." My next article by Kate Martin takes the form of a question and answer interview. It's titled Anonymous Kits. As North Carolina law enforcement agencies work through their backlog of more than 16,000 rape kits, they're finding DNA matches in a federal database that's helped them charge and convict several serial rapists. Not everyone who has survived a sexual assault wants to involve the police. Not everyone's ready to think about that yet. The aftermath of a sexual assault can be confusing time. Generally, you need to see a nurse within 4 days after the assault to receive proper medical care and preserve forensic evidence, but the sooner the better. But does this mean you're automatically pressing charges? No. North Carolina and other states have an option available to those who have been sexually assaulted that's called an anonymous kit. This means an assault victim can see a sexual assault nurse examiner, or SANE, S-A-N-E, nurse, at a hospital or certified community-based center for an exam, but not provide information to law enforcement. During the exam, the nurse documents injuries sustained in the assault and collects evidence that could be used in a future criminal trial. Not every hospital has a SANE nurse, and state law doesn't require that hospitals employ one. These nurses study and train for dozens of hours to learn how to help people who are sexually assaulted. For example, most people who visit the Solace Center in Raleigh after an assault are undecided about whether they want to involve law enforcement, said Lauren Schwartz, director of Sexual Assault Services and the director of the center located at Interact Family Safety and Empowerment Center in Raleigh. Schwartz said it's entirely possible to collect the forensic evidence and give the victim some breathing room in the aftermath of such a traumatic event before reporting it to law enforcement. And now the question and answer. What is an anonymous kit? All this means is that you are anonymous to law enforcement, said Schwartz. This means they won't know an assault took place or that there is any forensic evidence related to it. Because law enforcement doesn't know about the assault, it cannot count the assault in annual statistics reported to the federal government. Why could someone want an anonymous kit? Deciding to see a sexual assault nurse examiner is a big decision to begin with. Patients who are undecided or wary of law enforcement might not want to talk to police right away or at all. Some are afraid of what will happen if they do report, Schwartz said. Someone who has been sexually assaulted may fear that information will get out of their control or they won't have control over how to tell friends and family. Some patients might be in the middle of college exams, need to secure their safety, or are afraid of what their attacker will do, she added. An anonymous kit ensures the victim can be treated medically to prevent pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections, said John Summerdike, a former lieutenant with the Fayetteville Police Department. He said, if the survivor is ready at some point in the future to have an investigation conducted, they are the one in control, and they are the one who decides to get law enforcement involved. Does the DNA in anonymous kit get tested? No, said Schwartz. DNA in anonymous kits does not get tested, ever. State policies also say anonymous kits are not opened until the victim decides at a later date to involve law enforcement. If someone later decides to talk with law enforcement, then DNA will be tested if it meets the criteria. What happens to other forensic evidence in the kit? Schwartz said if law enforcement doesn't know about an assault, they can't investigate. Delaying a report to law enforcement can potentially destroy other forms of evidence. There could be evidence at a crime scene, or maybe camera footage, or evidence from a perpetrator. This may include items like bed sheets, carpets, or anything else that might have touched DNA during the assault. Can minors have an anonymous kit? It depends where the crime is reported, is this answer. Crimes committed against minors must be reported to police. This includes when a minor attacks another minor. In North Carolina, a minor is anyone under the age of 18. Schwartz said, based on state law, that would have to be reported to law enforcement, and if there was a kit collected, that would have to be tested. The only exemption, she said, is if the patient approaches a rape crisis center like the Solace Center for help. How often are anonymous kits filed? The precise yearly number is unknown. However, the best figure we have is based on the examination of North Carolina's decades-long backlog of untested rape kits. Of 16,200 untested rape kits in North Carolina, 1,385, or 8.5%, were filed as anonymous. What is the statute of limitations for sexual assault? All felonies in North Carolina have no statute of limitations. Prosecutors can decide to pursue a sexual assault case at any time, even if it occurred years ago. Some rapists are even charged and convicted decades after the crime occurred. If you have an anonymous kit, how long do you have to decide what to do? If people who have experienced a sexual assault want to qualify to receive reimbursement from the State Crime Victims Fund, they must report the crime to law enforcement within 72 hours. The fund only pays for medical care and loss of wages, not property damage or for pain and suffering. In North Carolina, hospitals are not allowed to bill victims of rape for their sexual assault exams, although it does happen. However, someone may decide at first to make the kit anonymous and decide much later to report the incident to law enforcement. There's no statute of limitations on reporting the crime. How long does the state store anonymous kits? State instructions for submitting these say the state will keep the kits in a warehouse indefinitely. Schwartz says as long as things were collected and preserved properly, the kit should be stable and able to sit on that shelf for a long time. State paperwork says while law enforcement will not know your personal information, the information is tracked by a state warehouse that stores the kit. Question. I had an anonymous kit. Now I'm ready to talk to law enforcement. What do I do? You notify the enforcement agency where the assault occurred and sign a consent form allowing the agency to access your kit. That agency then contacts the state warehouse, which retrieves the kit and provides it to that agency. After that, the agency can send your kit in for testing. Schwartz said her agency hangs on to anonymous kits for a couple of weeks before turning them into the state, on the chance the patient decides to report to law enforcement after the official exam. She says the more support a survivor has after an exam, and they're getting that experience with a nurse that's very trauma-informed, if they feel supported, then making that leap to talking to law enforcement is a little bit easier. Finally, I'd like more information and help. Whom can I call? Consider calling the National Sexual Assault Hotline. This phone number is 800-656-4673. That's 800-656-4673. Provided by RAINN, R-A-I-N-N, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. The network offers assistance 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's free and confidential. Well, folks, this is the weekend in Raleigh of the Hopscotch Festival. one of the most adventurous and far-ranging music festivals in the entire Southeast. And Jordan Lawrence pens this article in Independent, the Indie Week. How has that changed? Or has it changed? Hopscotch looks different these days. Launched in 2010, the festival has long been one of the most far-ranging and adventurous music festivals in the Southeast, expanding from an indie rock core to touch on metal, hip-hop, noise, and a variety of other experimental flavors across kaleidoscopic lineups that have surpassed 100 acts. At least one industry expert, though, sees it as something more typical, and that's Alex Maiolo. It's a festival that increasingly feels more like a point along the curve of the festival circuit. He explains that from his vantage, Hopscotch has become an event that's increasingly filled with acts that are routing through various festivals, rather than charting its own bold course as it once did. Maiolo admits this isn't a problem for everyone. A Chapel Hill-based musician and festival consultant, he advises and works with numerous big events, from South by Southwest in Austin to Roskilde Festival in Denmark and Tallinn Music Week in Estonia. He frequently travels the globe to play or write about various others, including Hopscotch. This experience causes him to feel keenly about the way Hopscotch has changed, he says. Quote, if these artists come to your town and you're not the type of person who can travel for music, that's really cool. But at the same time, it does mean it's a point along the curve festival rather than something that has the potential to stand out. Not everyone sees the way Hopscotch has changed in this light. Indie Week spoke to Maiolo and three others, the current festival director, a local artist playing this year who's also played several times in the past, and one of the event's co-founders, about the festival's shift in identity. All expressed different views and all agreed that the pandemic is a significant factor in Hopscotch's changing personality. If the reason there wasn't a Hopscotch in 2020, and it's the main reason the downtown Raleigh event has featured far fewer acts and indoor venues than it has in years past. It's long relied on bars and clubs to host the majority of its stages, featured 10 indoor venues when it celebrated its 10th annual edition in 2019. Last year it had none. This year it has two, Slim's and Poor House. As with last year, most of this year's act will play in two outdoor spaces, Hopscotch's traditional headlining stage in City Plaza, and a second main stage set up in Moore Square. The last pre-pandemic festival in 2019 featured 137 acts. This year, when Hopscotch returns September 8th through 10th, it will do with 46 acts, surpassing last year's mark of 28 by virtue of adding back two previously perennial club spaces. Adding back more than two clubs was just too uncertain a bet, given the lingering possibility that a surge in COVID-19 could have forced Hopscotch to nix its indoor programming, explains the festival director, Nathan Price. He says, it's just hard to say for sure we should go and spend all our money in the clubs, knowing there's at least a small chance it could end up backfiring. Price emphasizes that he still thinks Hopscotch has offered compelling programming in 2021 and 22, and that it has still managed to stay voracious, pointing to this year's lineup, featuring the slanted and enchanted rock of Courtney Barnett, Afrobeat royal Sion Kuti, and the Egypt 80, and widescreen country crooner Charlie Crockett among its headliners. But he admits that programming mostly on daytime outdoor stages has curtailed some of Hopscotch's wilder tendencies, though he offers the presence of lightning bolts, punishingly energetic noise rock in Moore Square as proof that Hopscotch still pushes the envelope. And while COVID was the big driver in pushing Hopscotch into its current format, Price says the pandemic isn't the only thing keeping the festival from reclaiming its club-based variety. He says, there's just not that many clubs in Raleigh right now. We have Slim's, Poor House, Lincoln Theater, which those three combined are like maybe 1,200 capacities altogether. Then King's is doing shows, but that wasn't for sure when we were planning stuff. So, you know, the other thing was just like, where do we put these shows? Even if everything goes perfect and nothing bad happens, what rooms are we actually booking here? Surpassing the number of regularly available spaces in downtown Raleigh is nothing new for Hopscotch. And all the interviewees Indy spoke with agreed it's a challenge that could hold the festival back going forward. Throughout its run, Hopscotch has transformed a Chinese restaurant, a modern art museum, and the basement of a convention center into venues. But success has become an enemy of such ingenuity, Price explains. When we launched originally, that was possible because, you know, bands were a little bit more forgiving about the spaces they play in. One of the reasons we don't do spaces anymore that just don't have a stage or production, it just costs so much to get a band, even mid-sized bands, into the space because their rider requirements and just the shows have gotten so much more sophisticated. It's not really a thing where you can have, like, throw up a PA. You have to have a lighting package. It's just gotten expensive. Now, Grayson Curran, who co-founded the festival back when he edited Indie Week's music section, zeroes in on Hopscotch's relationship with its home when explaining his outlook on the way the festival has changed. Raleigh is faceless, he says. I think Hopscotch is quickly trying to become faceless, too. Curran points to the rising cost of living in or near downtown as a factor, curtailing the creative energy that once fueled Hopscotch's ever-veering creative compass. He exited the festival in 2014 and credits Price with keeping Hopscotch going after co-founder Greg Loewenhagen also departed in 2016. A year after the festival was sold to E-Tix founder Travis Yanovich. But Curran questions the extent to which the new owner's desire to streamline costs has begun to stymie the festival's other ambitions. Admittedly, some of Hopscotch's more adventurous swings were expensive. Flying in the acclaimed noise artist Mirzbo from Tokyo to be the festival's improviser in residence for 2013, for instance. And Curran says that during his 4 years with the festival, it played jump rope with the line between making and losing money. Maintaining the festival's ethos, he argues, requires a willingness to shoulder these costs. Quote, Hopscotch was aspiring to be, from the start, a festival that did not exist. And the idea of that festival was to mix wildly experimental music, some indie music and hip-hop bordering or even getting to the mainstream, with local music, and to celebrate and put them on as equal footings as we could. Hopscotch, at this point, is not that kind of festival, and that's fine. It's different, but it's fine. Then Alex Riggs, a mercurial Durham-based singer-songwriter who will play their final show under the Al Riggs moniker in City Plaza this year, says that while Hopscotch has changed, and the number of acts and styles it can highlight on the local landscape has diminished, Hopscotch's new configuration provides more opportunities to highlight local music on its biggest stages. They add the festival balances its reduced local numbers by continuing to embrace the many free day parties that always pop up around the event, and that feature a ton of Triangle artists this year. There are more than 36 day parties. Club shows are also free to the public this year. With COVID still lingering and many of the venues Hopscotch had previously used being unavailable, Riggs says the festival can't really do much more for local artists right now, they say. Expecting it to be like what it was right away is unreasonable. And I may have the luxury of continuing with most of another arts and music piece, this by Nick McGregor, about Tatiana Hargreaves, titled More Than One String. Tatiana Hargreaves winces at the word prodigy, though it's a tempting one to apply. At 27 years old, the Durham resident has already achieved a lifetime of accomplishments. Expert fiddle player, prolific recording artist, lecturer, UNC Chapel Hill's Department of Music, celebrated documentarian of old-time music. It's also easy to view her through the lens of her childhood accolades. She followed in the footsteps of her older brother, Alex, by picking up the fiddle at age 3. At the age of 7, she blew minds at music camps in her native Oregon. At 13, she became the youngest person to win the Oregon Old Time Fiddlers Contest and just the second woman to win open fiddle at the Appalachian String Band Music Festival in Cliff Top, West Virginia, at the age of 14. She tells Indie Week over coffee and pastries at Monat's one recent hot August afternoon, "It's really cool that the bluegrass and old-time music community is so multi-generational, but the obsession with children who can play well is kind of bizarre. I'm grateful that people have supported me since a really young age. That's shaped my career, but it's also made me uncomfortable. There's this pressure to always stand out. You're a kid and you're so good, so what are you going to do next?" Perhaps that's the driving force behind Hargreaves' impressive resume. She earned a bachelor's degree in ethnomusicology and is 1 year away from finishing a master's in library science. She's aced fiery Texas fiddle, learned Cuban violin in Havana, and studied free improvisation with Indian and Pakistani musicians. She's written 4 movement suites based on literary classics and logged long hours at UNC's Southern Folklife Collection. She's digitized the extensive archive of living legend Alice Gerard and even expanded into producing the records of other roots musicians. "None of it was possible," Hargreaves said, "until she left her Oregon home and her history behind." Heading east, she landed first at Hampshire College in Massachusetts before moving to Durham in 2017 to study and work with Gerard. She says, "When I moved here, I didn't really know anyone besides Alice. I love that. I didn't have anyone expecting things from me. I was able to be myself in a way I'd never been before." That self is defined first by fiddle excellence, whether backing Bay Area icon Laurie Lewis in her The Right Hands band, leading local collective Hard Drive, or locking in with Canadian banjoist Alison DeGroote. Hargreaves' instrumental chops are evident as soon as bow meets string. She can scream through traditional tunes, 49 Cats in a Rain Barrel, bend uncanny notes into haunting combinations, Farewell Whiskey, or evoke lost American landscapes, Rolling River, wowing casual fans and fiddle nerds alike. Now, before I continue with this article, I want to make sure to mention that there is all article is about a concert, Tatiana Hargreaves with Sonia Badigan and McCain Lakey. That's in Durham at the Pinhook, and it's this coming Monday, September 12th at 8 p.m., with an admission price of only $10, folks. The Pinhook in Durham, Monday, September 12th at 8 p.m. So, Gerard says she immediately recognized a kindred spirit in Hargreaves, even though they're separated by 60 years in age. And, quote, "I first met Tatiana when she was 15, and I loved her fiddle playing. But what I really admire is that she's a traditionalist in many ways. We both like to keep one foot in the music itself and one foot in the story surrounding that music. That's a huge part of our connection. At this point, I feel she's part of my family." Familiar themes course through Hurricane Clarice, Hargreaves' second full-length album with DeGroote, which she released in March of this year. Full of her trademark hot fiddle, the concise 9-song record also reveals a more personal side of each musician, mixing audio recordings of their grandmothers with songs about polluted rivers, surrealist authors, black fiddlers, and supposed witches. Hargreaves says, "Allison and I really click. It's easy to immediately sync up with each other. I've never experienced that with anyone in a duo setting." The two worked on Hurricane Clarice with Triangle-based producer Phil Cook, who over Zoom encouraged them to be vulnerable. Quote, Phil gave us mostly emotional support. He said, once you're in the studio, I completely trust you. Just go in there and play. That's exactly what we needed to hear. It was my favorite recording experience ever. Hurricane Clarice is a remarkable example of the passionate landscape that can exist between two people, says Cook. I feel like I'm out riding out a storm on the ocean or looking over the Grand Canyon when I listen to the album. The expansiveness of it humbles me so much. The release of Hurricane Clarice also humbled Hargreaves, who was thankful to return to regular touring, but also struggled with the inevitable comedowns each time she returned home. It was the crash of everything you were avoiding on tour, all the emotions, the tasks, the lack of stimulation. For now, though, her studies, her ongoing partnership with Gerard and her work at the Southern Folklike Collection serve as a counterweight. I want to have more balance, she says. I find school and the archive work to be more emotionally regulating. It's nice to have something reliable and someone telling me what to do. Her studies have also broadened how she teaches others. When people come to me to study, they often have a specific idea about what fiddle means or bluegrass means. The biggest part of my studies is wanting to make it easier for people to find stuff on their own. That endless discovery extends to every part of Hargreaves' career. And unfortunately, I must curtail this article now with about several paragraphs left. Indie Week and IndieWeek.com is your source for all these articles if you wish to rehear them or reread them yourselves. And, of course, that's available online. And I'm missing the opportunity to talk about the closing of a venue, C. Grace. They're calling it quits, the jazz club. And another long article about a couple in Durham who's saying a well-known retired Durham judge wrongfully evicted them from a place of business. I apologize about that, but time constraints indicate that we have to close it up. And so John Feddersen for the North Carolina Reading Service says farewell for now. We'll be back hopefully again in a week with the next issue of Indie Week at the North Carolina Reading Service. Thanks very much, everybody, for listening.